Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, the third leading cause of death in the United States, isn't typically associated with weight loss. But there is a connection. Elaine Howley wrote about the COPD and weight loss connection recently for U.S. News and World Report. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Can you define what COPD is, how it compares to, say, like asthma or bronchitis or anything like that?
Sure. So COPD is actually a kind of an umbrella term for two conditions, chronic bronchitis and emphysema. And in many patients who have COPD, they may well have elements of both diseases. And it's a chronic progressive condition, so there's currently no cure. There are some treatments available, but it's the result of damage to the lungs. And whereas asthma often has an allergy component and is triggered by an environmental factor, with COPD, it's an ongoing struggle to breathe because the lungs have been damaged, they aren't functioning properly, and the airflow is obstructed.
It is the third leading cause of death in the United States. What causes it?
The primary risk factor for COPD is cigarette smoking. About 90% of people who are diagnosed with COPD were heavy smokers, and some of them still smoke. And generally speaking, the best way to address COPD is to stop smoking as soon as possible.
And the symptoms, what has it done to the lung tissue, and what are the symptoms?
Sure. So over time, cigarette smoke or other inhaled irritants can lodge in the lungs and damage the cells. And at a certain point, the lung tissue isn't able to recover or regenerate itself. And so this becomes a cumulative effect. And many people who are diagnosed with COPD may have smoked heavily in the past but quit 30 years ago. But because the damage was done, as they continue to age and the body slows down in its own natural repair process, the symptoms can come on later. And the symptoms often include breathlessness, not being able to do tasks with the same vigor that you once did. Patients will find out that they have COPD as a result of what's called an exacerbation. They'll end up in the hospital with pneumonia or another lung problem, and then learn that it's actually a worsening of the underlying COPD.
So if I slow down, that means that, you know, if I slowed down my activity today, I would slap on the pounds faster than you could say COPD. But people who have COPD have a hard time keeping weight on. Why is that?
Yeah, certainly in some cases, as the disease progresses, they end up with a condition called pulmonary cachexia, which is actually a muscle wasting syndrome. And basically what's happening is there's an energy imbalance. They require so much energy just to breathe and to bring oxygen into the lungs and pump it throughout the body that, the metabolic rate, they can't address all of these energy needs through normal dietary habits. And what's more is that especially with patients with emphysema, they can end up with air trapped in their lungs because it's so obstructed that it can't, the spent air struggles to come back out of the lung. And so they can get hyperinflated chest, which then pushes the lungs down onto the stomach, which means that they're not able to eat as much as they would in a normal sitting. So over time, weight loss can become a problem, and it can become a signifier of poor prognosis in some patients.
What do you mean a signifier for prognosis?
It means that the disease is progressing and they're not doing as well.
We said it's third leading cause of death. The COPD, people just actually suffocate to death?
More or less, yeah. They really struggle to breathe and get the oxygen that they need into their system. And that's why you'll see some patients with advanced disease, they'll be on oxygen support. They'll have the oxygen tube up into the nose. And that can be a difficult treatment, but it's a very helpful treatment for patients with advanced disease.
It's preventable, and it's also can be associated with some people are genetically predisposed to it. What's that connection?
Yeah, so there are potentially a couple of genetic factors at work, because obviously not every smoker ends up with COPD. So there's some additional factor there. It's not necessarily that just because you have smoked, you will develop COPD. And they think, so researchers have discovered that there's this protein called alpha-1 antitrypsin. It's manufactured in the liver, and in patients who have a deficiency of this, what happens is the liver is still creating the protein, but it gets trapped inside the liver, and it can't go to the lungs. And the protein is useful in the lungs in repairing damaged tissue there. So people with anti-1 alpha-trypsin deficiency, they can end up with either liver disease because there's too much of this protein in the liver because it can't get out, mm-hmm. or there's not enough. They can end up with lung disease because there's not enough in the lungs to repair them. And that alpha-1, I think is I think the statistic is about 2 to 3% of cases of COPD are the result of alpha-1. So it's relatively rare, but it is definitely been identified as a genetic basis for some COPD cases. There's speculation and a lot of research going on right now into other potential genetic links to this disorder.
And getting back to the body weight thing, you recently reported that their liquid shakes and dietary supplements have proved useful in these cases?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. For severely underweight patients, malnourishment can be a problem, again, because they can't take in as much food as they need or as they should because of the reduction of volume available in the stomach. And, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times there'll be a suppression of appetite alongside this as well.
They're just too stinking tired.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, it sounds awful to be that exhausted just from breathing. So some doctors will prescribe patients to do meal replacement shakes, and certainly following a healthy diet is a very important tenet of treating the disease. It's part of pretty much every pulmonary rehabilitation program, and virtually all COPD patients upon diagnosis will be enrolled into a pulmonary rehab program, which includes education and exercises that can help them strengthen their lungs and their core muscles to help them breathe better. And then there's usually also a dietary or nutritional component to this program that can help them get the nutrients they need.
What kind of exercises are they talking about?
Sure. So pretty much anything is good. Any kind of physical activity is good. Yoga is one that I wrote about recently that is actually very helpful because it's gentler than some of the more aerobic or, you know, Western-style exercises that are mm-hmm. out there. So with yoga, a focus on stretching and breath work and certain postures, you know, making sure that your posture is good can also help give your lungs a little more space to maneuver, which can be helpful in easing breathing.
When I see people with oxygen tanks walking around, they don't tend to be young. They tend to be older. Is COPD something you can have but put off the symptoms of from it until you're older?
Well, it definitely afflicts older patients more because it's a progressive disease. If you started smoking when you're 18, you're starting to accumulate the damage that could result in COPD down the line. But it takes time to get there, and the added element of aging and the body not being able to repair itself as optimally as we age is certainly a factor here. So, yeah, you do usually see COPD patients are usually older.
And is there a screen for COPD? So you've been smoking for 10 years. Can you go in and somebody can look at your lungs and tell you if you have it?
Well, sure. The way it's diagnosed is through what's called a spirometry test, where you breathe into a tube and there's a ball in there and it measures how forceful your exhale is. And there's various different ways to stage, you know, how you've done in that process. So different ways to determine how blocked your airflow is and whether that is COPD. Your doctor might also prescribe chest x-rays to take a look at what's going on inside the lungs. But yeah, spirometry is the primary way to diagnose COPD.
You've written that some people may be candidates for one of three surgical procedures to treat the disease. What are the surgical procedures?
Sure. So they are lung transplant is sort of the end of the line. Yeah. But before you get to that, there's a procedure called bilectomy, There's another procedure called lung volume reduction surgery. Now, lung volume reduction surgery sounds like a total counterintuitive way to approach the problem.
Yeah.
If I can't breathe, why would I want my lungs to have less volume? Well, the problem is that it's addressing that trapped air that can get stuck in the lungs. And so by going in and removing part of the lung, the most diseased part of the lung, that then opens up the healthy part of the lung to be able to process the air that you're breathing in a little bit more effectively. With bullectomy, it's a similar principle. So bulla are these, they're almost like a balloon. To think of it as like a balloon inside the lung, and they're an emphysematous space that is usually a centimeter or larger in size. And these can get huge in advanced cases of COPD. They can get up to about 8 inches. So if you think about having a balloon that's inflated about 8 inches inside your lungs, you can start to understand why, you know, removing something might be useful to improving the way you breathe. So with a bullectomy, they'll go in and they'll remove those bulla to give you a better airflow going in and out of the lungs. And then finally, with lung transplant, it's, you know, they give you a new set of lungs, and that would be only in very advanced cases where all other options have been exhausted.
Who qualifies for those kinds of things? I mean, do they judge by age, by other health issues going on at the same time?
Yeah, certainly. Age, health of the patient is critical, especially with lung transplants, because these surgeries are not minor undertakings. So you want to make sure that the patient is healthy enough to withstand general anesthesia and, you know, the recovery process, because we're talking about some incisions and, you know, there's also a lot of risks associated with any kind of surgery for infection or other complications. So definitely they assess the overall health of the patient and also the stage at which the disease has progressed to. So, you know, if you're in a more advanced state of disease and medications and oxygen don't seem to be working as well for you, then they might consider a surgical option.
Do people with COPD, is there any typical, what's the word, is it comorbidity? Is there any other kinds of illness or disease that tends to go along with it? Like lung cancer, for instance, do they have a higher rate of lung cancer?
I don't really know about the lung cancer connection specifically, mm-hmm. but it would stand to reason that there could be a connection there. But definitely a comorbidity here would be a cardiovascular disease.
Okay.
You know, lung and heart issues often travel together. You know, and if your lungs are compromised, then your heart can have some difficulty as well. So those two are definitely linked.
Elaine Howley, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, well, thank you for having me and for taking a look at COPD.
Elaine Howley, she's a freelance health reporter. You can look at her articles about COPD in the U.S. News and World Report at the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesday is coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Run the hill, jump the tires, crawl through the mud. Obstacle course racing has exploded in popularity. Participants want to do more than just run, and it's getting closer to becoming an Olympic sport. Races such as Tough Mudder, Spartan races, or Warrior Dashes have gone from relative obscurity to surpassing traditional marathoning and triathlons and biathlons, all combined in terms of the number of racers. Central Ohio fitness instructor at Chris Szabo has trained amateurs to both survive and enjoy obstacle course races. She joins us now in the studio. And full disclosure, I have trained for obstacle course races with Chris. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Anne. It's great to be here again. Thanks.
Listeners, have you signed up for or completed an obstacle course race? How did you train for it? Or do you have any questions for Chris about how to train for it? Let us know. Call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Chris, give us a thumbnail of what do these races typically consist of? What kind of physical challenges can you expect?
Well, what's really great about them is they are outside. So you have to deal with sort of natural elements. I mean, they obviously make them a little more challenging. So that's really fun. And it's also all upper body and lower body. So it's an all-over body workout, which is great. And the way that we have trained, which you have a little bit of experience with that, we go outside. So my biggest thing is when people ask, well, how do I train for that? It's to actually train in the element you're going to actually race in or compete in.
You know, I notice with workouts when we do them outdoors or indoors, there is a difference. Why is that? Is it just the air you're breathing or what? Is it psychological?
It's probably a combination of everything.
Okay.
Yes, outside, I mean, you've got to deal with the elements, right? So you have to deal with the humidity, the rain, the snow, the wind, the sun, all of that. And so that's huge. And then psychologically, you know, that combines. Because some people are really good in the heat and some people are really bad in the heat. So, for instance, when we had trained a couple years ago for, I want to say it was the Spartan, I'm mixing them. We started on March 1st and we got a huge snowfall and it was about 6 inches or 8 inches, something like that. And we still have to train for it because it doesn't matter because they'll tell you that day of that race, it could be whatever.
And there have been a whatevers.
Oh, yeah.
There was one a couple years ago where you guys were, it was freezing.
Yeah. So that was in October of 2014. 2014. It was one of the best. You could ask all the Worthington Warriors that did this race. It was probably one of the best experiences of their life and the worst. We all survived for real. I mean, there was some hypothermia at the end of that race. Joe DeSena, who is the founder of the Spartan series, it's interesting. I think that they've changed when they have those races in the Midwest because the elements were bordering not okay because we had hit some hail and rain and it was really cold and they weren't ready for that kind of thing at the end of that race. But yeah, that was for real.
How do you recommend somebody choose which race to sign up for if they're going to a first race kind of a thing?
Oh, yeah. So if you're interested in doing an adventure race, an obstacle course race, first of all, that's awesome. I think it's a great experience. I think you need to start out with something on the shorter side. So a Warrior Dash is a great way to start.
Those are about, what, three and a half miles?
It's a 5K race, 3.1 miles.
Okay.
Generally, that's like the typical amount. And it's really fun. It's pretty well organized for the most part. So I think having an element of fun to the challenge is really important when you're starting something new like that, because if it's just going to be all grueling experience, you might never want to come back. And we did the Warrior Dash. Mm-hmm. A lot of people did that, and that was their foray into obstacle course racing. They loved it, so they kept going for it.
I've done obstacle course races by myself and with groups. Do you have a recommendation for that?
I am biased. I do think that it depends on the individual. I think doing it with a group or a team is awesome. So, for instance, we trained as a team for all of our obstacle course races. And I think if you were to talk to any of those team members, the training piece of working towards that goal was immensely valuable for them, which made the end result all the more, you know, memorable. So I think training with a group is really great. And then showing up at the race day, you have all that camaraderie and you have more of that energy behind you to finish it and to be proud of.
You know, one of the attractions of the obstacle course race thing is that you don't necessarily know what's coming up around the corner, down the hill, through the river,
right,
and across the woods, or over the river and through the woods. That sense of unexpectedness, that's a thing in athleticism in general, isn't it?
It is, actually. And what I think is interesting about the rise in obstacle course racing for adults is if you think a lot of the people I think that are attracted to it were once athletes when they were younger or on some sort of team. And that's kind of a lost thing as you get to middle age or beyond, you know, you kind of, and then what happens is when you get that experience again, it can kind of recreate a lot of those things for you. And I think the element of challenge and surprise as we get older is harder to come by. And so these races give people the opportunity to do that and have that.
It's something about, I don't know if there's an adrenaline that goes into facing a wall that you have to climb that's 30 feet high, and you have to then go back down the other side once you get up it. And you think you can't do it, but...
But you do.
Yeah.
You do. So, I mean, you do if you train for it and if you have a team with you that can help you out, I think. Those are the two things. So there's absolutely adrenaline that can help you get through, but training for it's real important.
Is it the Spartan that if you don't do one of the obstacles, you have to do 30...
burpees.
Burpees, like,
yes.
Just kill me. Stick a needle in my eye. 30 burpees is horrible.
Oh, come on now, Anne.
It is.
So, yes, like when we trained...
Are they really rigid about that?
Actually, the first Spartan we did was the Spartan Super, which was supposed to be 8 miles, but it ended up being about 13.
Another one of those issues, yeah.
Yeah, so there was an element of that surprise, which, whatever. So every obstacle, the way we trained for that is every obstacle, you know, we did a ton of burpees. So you were ready for if there was an obstacle you couldn't do or couldn't finish that you were going to do that. So we were very... honest with those, but I don't think it was really on the honor system.
Okay.
For the most part.
And when I've been, I think it was Warrior Dashes before, there's a lot of people that do those things that they just walk their way through the whole thing. They don't do half the obstacles, but that's okay, right? I guess.
I think it's okay.
Well, sometimes I want them to get out of the way, but that's just me.
I think that that's the challenge, right? So I think it's great, and I want to applaud anyone that wants to get out there and do the work and challenge themselves. I think the race directors have realized this over time. There's different, going to be different categories. So there's going to be like an elite division. So the people that are in that division should be able to go a lot quicker. Because what happens when you've got the walkers with the backpacks right from the get-go, they're going to bottleneck on a single track in the woods.
Right.
And so that becomes real challenging because if you want to run and you don't want to walk, you know, you sometimes don't have a choice.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about obstacle course racing now. It takes all different kinds of forms, everything from mud baths to slides to wall climbing walls to, yeah, you name it. My guest is Chris Szabo. She's a fitness instructor and owner of Szabo Fitness. If you have a question or comment about obstacle course races, if you've done one, you want to tell us your experience, I'd love to hear about it. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out the Facebook page. I think I linked to the All Sides Facebook page a photo of Chris finishing a race with a couple of her team members from Worthington Warriors. You can check that out. You can do some of the training, though, in a traditional gym, right?
Absolutely, you can. Absolutely, you can. So, and you know this, but I'm generally not a gym rat. So I like to do as much as I can outside. I think you can do a lot with your body weight, and I think you can get real creative with the outdoors, which is ultimately what happened with these races. So when we have trained for them, a lot of it was outdoors, but I also teach boot camps and we're inside. You can do so much inside. You can use weights, you can use the gym, you can, you know, use your body, you can do partner work. So there's all kinds of ways. But if you solely work in the gym to do a race that's outdoors, you are going to really have a shock when you do that. It's going to be extra hard. It's better to work in the humidity or the snow or the rain so you're ready for that come race day.
What are some of the risks associated with obstacle events, assuming that you're trying to run the event and do it fast versus the walk and
right.
toddle around the obstacle approach?
Well, not to be morbid, but you do sign a waiver, a death waiver.
Very fine print, if I remember.
Let's be clear. It's like 3 pages long. But you sign that because there is a lot of risk in these races. So on a serious note, that's why it's real important to train for it. So obviously the risk of death in anything, you can break something, you can twist something,
they will rescue you.
They will. They're not going to leave you for dead. They might. Right. They might have that October, but nobody was left for dead. So that's great. but yeah, there's a lot of medical staff on hand, but, you know, you have to, when you sign up, you take that risk of I could fall or, you know, twist something.
I fell in a creek and cut my leg pretty badly. Not horrible, but the worst part was the place I had to go through some of these mud baths after that. And Lordy only knows what was in that.
Yeah, bacteria, and that's great.
Yeah, so I went straight to the med tent after I got off the course.
Smart choice. Well, I mean, some people won't do these because, you know, you have to go and be submerged into a, you know, a muddy pit of
sounds like
something.
Fun to me. I don't know what it is, but
so you just hold your nose and go for it.
So let's talk about some of the obstacles that you've seen that that gives people an idea of just typical obstacles, and then maybe some more of the more unusual ones you've seen.
Okay. Well, there's always some sort of cargo net involved, right? So you're going to have to climb the cargo net. It's usually not attached at the bottom. Seems easy enough, but you know, you get that mental aspect when you get towards the top of that thing that, ooh, I got to get to the other side. And so sometimes you can work as a team to get over that. A lot of times it's best to just have somebody at the other end waiting for you. There's always going to be a wall that you have to either run up or, you know, get up and then jump down the other side. I was just at an obstacle course race this past weekend. I was not doing it. I was spectating. But there was, I want to call it, it was called Dragon's Back. It was pretty cool. It was the Indian Run in Coshocton, Ohio.
Oh, okay.
And there was three different walls, and you had to jump from one to the other, but they were about, I don't know, 8 feet apart. And it was pretty intense, but it was amazing how people did it and figured it out. And I can't remember what race it was. Maybe it was the Tough Mudder. There was a trapeze. You had to, you know, climb real high, get on that thing, swing over the water and get to the other side. And if you didn't, you just dropped right in the water. So a lot of upper body strength, I would say that's huge in these obstacle course races.
Yeah.
You got to get yourself, you know, up a rope or down, you know, down a wall or something. And then there's a running piece too.
Which is the hardest part. For me. I'm sorry, I had to finish that sentence. Not for everybody.
For everybody.
Running on uneven ground, that's a new experience for a lot of people. You know, you coach cross country at
Grandview High
Grandview,
School.
Right.
I do. So I have a background in uneven running, I guess, and on uneven ground, I should say. And I think it's a great place to train for those races. So if you're going to train for a race like this, you don't want to just go outside and run on the pavement or on a nice smooth path. It's good to build up to uneven ground or do a little bit at a time, going on some sort of like rocky path or at high banks is great. And then get yourself on some, it'll help build up your strength in your ankles.
And then running up hills are often a part of this.
Absolutely.
Big hills, not Central Ohio hills.
Well, right. That's right. Some can be really steep. Some can be really long and, you know, arduous. So, yeah, you want to do some hill training in there. You want to be able to really it's mixing up some cardio and some strength and being able to sustain yourself over a period of time and building that up over time to be able to make it through the whole race.
I remember, I think it was a Warrior Dash. It was a mile and a half. The first mile and a half of the race was uphill. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
And then the how to hydrate yourself properly. Any thoughts about that?
Oh, yeah.
They're usually handing it out, but.
Well, excuse me. So I think it really depends on the length of the race you're doing. I think a 5K, most folks can probably get through that without doing a lot of hydrating or gel or goo or anything like that. Generally, people now these days feel like they're overhydrating. I'm such an old school with that. But I think the longer you get, it's like for every 45 minutes you're out there, about 40 minutes, you should be taking some sort of gel and drinking some water. And then obviously, if it's really humid, you're going to want to add on to that as well. So, you know, some of these races are 3-4 hours, so you better have a couple of gel packs on you, and then hopefully there's some water stations along the way.
In obstacle racing, you want to go fast, but you also need to be safe. So how do you balance that? When do you know when to just slow down and take it easy for a little while? What are some of the warning signs, I guess?
Well, I think you gotta, when you train, I mean, you start to learn to listen to your body. So you want to listen to your body and not go out too quickly. I mean, that's one of the things that we talked about is you don't want to go out too fast. You do that, you're going to really pay for it later. It's like if you decide to run 26.2 miles and you try to burn out that first 3 miles, you're going to have a real hard time those last, you know, 23. So that, and then on some of these races, I suggest running with a buddy. So you have somebody in case something happens that you can lean on or can help you through, whether it's psychologically or to help you get over a wall or something like that.
How big of a deal is it to place in these races?
I think it depends on who you are.
Yeah.
I think it depends. I think competitiveness can be very private for some, just between, you know, what can I accomplish from when I did it before, or I've never done this, I just want to finish it. And then some people get to the place where, you know, hey, like, I've done this a lot and I want to see how I do compared to others.
So that kind of bummed me out when I did a race and they weren't ranking people.
Yeah. So
that's something you can ask about before you sign up, right? If it matters to you.
Absolutely, you can. And like I said, some of these races will have different divisions, and it can be based on age or it can be based on time.
Yeah.
So that can
be helpful
like with
age
that.
Because
you know.
The older you get, the better you're
The master's division is an option sometimes.
Chris Sabo, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome. It's always good to be here.
That's Chris Sabo. She's a fitness instructor, owner of Sabo Fitness. We've been talking about obstacle course races. If you have any stories you want to... Well, hang on one second. I want to get this call. Frank in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Ann.
Go ahead.
I was calling to ask about, so like as far as uneven running goes, like if there's a good place in Columbus or close to Columbus, especially on the west side, to do that. I come from South Bend and they have parks there that just have trails that you can run on with hills and stuff, but all the metro parks around here are all like, all the trails are paved or they have gravel on.
Yeah. Any ideas, Chris?
Hi, Frank. I think that it's kind of a haul for you, but the Audubon Park downtown off Whittier is really great. They actually have some obstacles already built there that you can use, and you can run, you know, you can run different loops in the grass and whatnot. Also, I had mentioned earlier the Metro Park High Banks, which is way up on the north side, is an amazing park. We have hills up there. There's trails. And then you can even go in the grass. And I think that that's probably one of the hilliest metro parks we've got.
And intern Owen Doherty says Caesar Creek State Park, 40 minutes south. Apparently some good running trails down there. Good question, Frank. Thanks a lot for that. And again, Chris Sabo, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
More Wellness Wednesday is coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Baby food. It should be the safest food of all. Yet a recent study conducted by the nonprofit Environmental Defense Fund detected lead in 20% of baby food samples. It found traces of lead in other foods as well. Joining us by phone is food safety and health communication scholar at Arizona State University Center for Research on Ingredient Safety, Carrie Shada. Carrie was an independent reviewer for the study. Welcome back, Carrie.
Thanks so much, Ann. Good to be here.
Also joining us is Chemicals Policy Director at the Environmental Defense Fund and lead author of the study, Tom Neltner. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
Tom, how did you conduct this study? What did you do?
Well, we looked at 11 years of FDA data and found that lead was found in 20% of the baby food samples compared to 14% for other foods. And that there were some types, eight types in particular, that had detectable lead in 40% of the samples. Then also we found that in the cases of apple and grape juice and carrots, that baby food lead was more commonly found in baby food than in regular versions of the same products. All of that led us to dig deeper into the issue. And what we found is that when you add all the little bits of lead in food together, that more than a million children consume more lead on a regular basis than FDA would say is acceptable.
Is this a brand thing, or is it more the type of food?
It's right now, we don't have brand information.
Okay.
FDA doesn't collect that. There may be brand information coming shortly, but we don't have it now. We really don't know. Right now, all we know is types of food.
And how did they test for the lead? How does the FDA do its tests?
This is a study that they've been doing for almost a half century, where they send people out to different regions of the country, different cities, and they buy 286 different types of food. About 57 of those are baby food. And then they blend the samples together and they get these results. And we based it on the blended results. Because it's blended, that's why we don't have brand information.
Carrie Shada, how much lead is deemed safe by the Food and Drug Administration? I guess I'm kind of wondering why the Environmental Defense Fund is telling us this and not the FDA.
I guess I don't know if I can speak for either the FDA or the Environmental Defense Fund. What I can say is that the amount of lead allowed in food will vary depending on the type of food. Okay, so one of the base levels that we're looking at is that FDA allows 5 parts per billion of lead contamination in bottled water.
And was Tom Neltner, the difference between baby food and regular adult food, what's the significance there?
It raises questions because, as you pointed out, most people would think baby food would have lower levels of lead, that they'd be better. And what we find is that's not necessarily the case. Now, recognize we're looking at levels that are relatively low. So it's only when you add them together that these numbers get significant. We did look at the economic impact. So we said when you add it all up for children's exposure, the economic impact is about $27 billion a year from lead in food. So if you could eliminate it, you could add $27 billion back to the economy in better lifetime earnings by getting those IQ points back.
I'm trying to figure out how it's even legal for baby foods to contain lead. What do we know about how the lead's getting in there? Tom?
Well, there hasn't been a rigorous study of where the lead's coming from. FDA tends to assume it's from the soil and treat it as if it's a fact of life. They can't get rid of it. Yet we know from the soil there's still aviation gasoline. So lead is still used in gasoline for small airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
It's also from past uses in pesticides and gasoline for cars and paint. So there's a lot of sources. The oddest number is, why would it be more in the baby food for the juices than for the regular juices? And frankly, that suggests that processing is a part of it. And that means it's something we can prevent.
Carrie Shada, are there any regulations about how, let's just talk about baby food for a second, how baby food is processed?
I'm not aware of that in terms of specific processing for baby food. I don't know, Tom, is that something that you're aware of?
No, FDA only sets special standards for infant formula. And that is part of the baby food in this case, but that's not what they didn't find lead in the baby's, in the infant formula. It was in the other brand or the other types.
And so when you talk about gasoline in airplanes, you're saying that maybe when food, like raw materials, are being shipped, that could be what's going on?
Well, we don't really know. But, you know, if an airplane is burning leaded gasoline over the field, that lead is going to settle out on the crop.
Okay, I see.
It could also be in the soil where it can be absorbed into it. For example, we found carrots and sweet potatoes or two of those 8 types with really high common detection. So, that could be from lead in the ground. Lead is natural in the ground, but the types of levels we're seeing are not from Mother Nature. They're from man-made activities. And the good news is, on some types, lead is less common. So it means that we just have to work with manufacturers and FDA to start finding out how to eliminate it and try to reduce the levels of lead by better managing the supply chain and looking at how they process the food.
Kirishita, are there efforts to do a better job of that from you know, where you sit? Do you see the industry taking note?
I think Tom will have more information because maybe you've been talking to some industry members. I hate to keep pushing all the answers to you, but I think there is, things that can be done. Because we know that some samples are coming back as non-detectable, so that's good. And in fact, the majority of them are, but there's a significant number that are coming back as just having detectable amounts of lead and some that are fairly high. So I think it's really important and something that industry can take leadership around with looking at what's being done right in terms of getting those samples with no detectable levels of lead and what they can improve on for, examining the sources that are testing much higher.
Tom Neltner, how has industry responded to this report by the Environmental Defense Fund?
Well, most of them were surprised by the numbers because FDA, for instance, has said that grape juice is acceptable at 50 parts per billion, which is 10 times higher than it allows in bottled water. So FDA in many ways has made it clear that it's not the priority. So as we've talked to industry, there's many companies that are taking a progressive approach to it. Some of them describe it as all natural, lead is all natural, but we know that that's not the case. I do think that as we've reached out to manufacturers, they're trying to figure out where it's from and make reductions, which is good news. And FDA has said it's going to reevaluate its standards. Those standards, the FDA says 6 micrograms per lead per day of lead per day is tolerable. That those standards were set in 1993. It's been almost a quarter century, and we know that lead is more dangerous than we thought it was in 1993. So one important task is for FDA to update its numbers and then start communicating that to the industry. But we know that industry shouldn't wait, and many of the leaders in industry are not waiting.
I mean, is this something that if I made my own, let's talk about baby food, because it's that's a time in a person's life when lead poisoning is the most damaging. Could I make my own baby food?
Yes, that would help. I think some of the evidence would suggest that, but I don't really know because we don't know where the lead's coming from. In other words, if you buy sweet potato or carrot, in the store, they may be more likely to have it. Although it's odd that the carrots, the pureed carrot baby food. Three times more likely, lead was more found 3 times more likely in the baby food puree than in the regular made up from carrots that you buy at the store. So it does suggest that peeling well makes a big difference. Peeling deeply.
Kirishita, is there anything you can look on ingredients, on labels at the ingredients to indicate, to suggest anything to the consumer at this point?
Not that I'm aware of. No, I don't think so. Yeah, that we're not sure where which samples are having the lead higher or not. So I don't think that's something. It's certainly not something that's going to be on the label.
So what do you recommend consumers do to address this issue?
Well, I think the biggest thing is, as Tom said, the government industry can take steps to work on this problem, so to the extent that consumers can encourage both of those sectors to make changes, ask their favorite brands whether they're testing for lead, those are good things. At the individual level, it's going to be hard to know where, what food is having, has more lead in it or not. So it's more at the, big U.S. food supply issue. One of the things that EDF found was that there was higher levels of detection in fruit juice, and I think that's an easy win for parents because fruit juice is not recommended for young children anyway. They should be eating whole fruits instead, and so I think that's one small step that parents could take.
And Tom Neltner, you're saying the next step is the FDA has to recognize these things. I mean, what do you think people can do to address this issue?
Well, I think Kerry got it right. I think it's talking to their favorite brands and asking them, what are you doing to reduce the level? What are your test results and what are your standards? Many of these companies do that. I think they're anticipating it. They may not want to give you the results, but that's the kind of information that they should provide you to be transparent about their decisions. I think many companies will respond constructively to that, and if they're not, that's something you should think about when you make your purchasing decisions.
Do you? I wanted to ask you, Tom Neltner, what triggered your interest in this issue in the first place?
Well, I've worked on lead poisoning prevention for 20 years. I grew up in Ohio, and much of my adult life was in Indiana, where I worked with lead poisoned children, focused on paint, which is the biggest source of lead, and recently, been about 4 years ago, started working on water, well before Flint.
Mm.
But we saw a report from the Environmental Protection Agency where they did an assessment of where is all the lead coming from, and food jumped up to the top. And again, it's not that you get the high level from food, it's that everybody gets exposed. And when you add together those little exposures, they become significant.
Once again, once lead gets into the system, it's hard to get rid of, right?
Into the body?
Yeah, into the body.
Well, the body does get rid of it over time,
uh-huh.
So it doesn't accumulate in the same way, but what lead does is it gets into the brain and it causes damage in the brain. And it's best measured by the IQ loss, the IQ points. And that's how we came up with that $27 million a year estimate of children on average would be losing a little less than an IQ point. Or half IQ points. And that's significant when you think about 4 million children a year getting exposed.
And why is it that it's more dangerous for children?
Well, that's where all the evidence is. There's increasing evidence that it's not good for adults or teenagers as well. But for young children, it can penetrate through the blood-brain barrier where it can do more damage. As we get past 6 years old, lead is better able to stay out of the brain. And therefore, the damage is less.
Going forward, I mean, are you going to follow this issue with the FDA and its testing regimen and that kind of a thing?
I've been working on lead for 20 years, so yeah. I'm not going to let go of it. Yes, I've been working with FDA on all kinds of food additive issues for the past 7.
Uh-huh.
I think FDA is serious about this one. It's really time for them to catch up to the science. And I think they're going to take it on. But again, I don't think companies should wait. Companies should be acting now and not waiting on FDA to make a decision.
Well, I guess the question then is, can we expect lead-free on labels coming up in the future?
I think getting to zero is not possible.
Okay.
True zero.
Yeah.
I think what we want to do is drive these levels down as low as possible. Unfortunately, because we had decades of using lead in paint, in gasoline, in everything, mm-hmm. we've now, in pesticides, that it's going to take a long time to clean it up, but we haven't focused enough on the food side of it and how we can reduce those.
Tom Neltner, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Tom Neltner is the Chemicals Policy Director at the Environmental Defense Fund. We'll have a link to reports about the study they did about dietary lead exposure with a focus on food intended for babies and young children. Also, Kerry Shada, thanks for joining us as well. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Good to talk with you.
Kerry Shada, food safety and health communication scholar at Arizona State University Center for Research on Ingredient Safety. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.